It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll talk to Bon Appetit editor Molly Baz about her new cookbook that gives us cooking lessons with each recipe. First, SSM Health announced last month that would require all employees to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 by September. They're not alone. Earlier this week, nearly 60 healthcare groups across the country said they support mandatory COVID vaccines for all people working in healthcare and long-term care. We're talking about vaccination requirements for health workers, starting with the example of SSM Health, which employs workers in four states, including Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you work in healthcare yourself? What are your thoughts on the idea of your employer mandating the COVID vaccine for you and your fellow health workers? What do you want people to know about what it's been like to work in the medical field during this pandemic? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Matt Hanley is the interim regional president for SSM Health with Wisconsin. Dr. Hanley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What went into this decision, Dr. Hanley, to require employees at SSM Health to get vaccinated against COVID-19?
Yeah, thanks for the question. We have obviously been monitoring this pandemic, and we have, all along, once the vaccine became available, strongly encouraging our team members to get vaccinated. And that is based on really the simple fact that we know vaccines are safe and effective. We have a number of experts at our system. We spend the time, reading the papers, doing the research, to really help support our decision. We had not planned on making it a requirement until, after the vaccine had received the full FDA approval, which we're hoping is going to come to fruition in the next month or two. But the Delta variant, the rise of the Delta variant, changed our mind. And, based on the research that we had done, reading the research, having experts, pour over the data, we came to the conclusion last month that the Delta variant is a different virus, more contagious, higher rate of infectivity, higher in terms of causing morbidity and mortality and hospitalizations. And with the, what we were seeing in terms of the rapid spread, it forced us to make that decision, based on it being a patient safety issue.
Right. And this may seem obvious to people, but can you talk about the importance of getting healthcare workers in particular vaccinated, given their exposure, first of all, to sick people and sick people's exposure to them?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think... Well said. I mean, we're a healthcare provider. My number one job, our number one job is to take care of our patients, keep our patients safe, keep our coworkers safe, and keep our communities safe. We know that vaccines are the single most effective way to do that within the pandemic. And we also know that we also take care of vulnerable populations whereby some of the conventional measures of prevention are not as effective. And so we absolutely have an obligation to play a role in keeping patients safe.
At your clinics and elsewhere in healthcare, I know frontline healthcare workers were some of the earlier people eligible to get vaccinated, which makes sense. What do you know about vaccination rates among healthcare workers without these mandates?
Yeah, so I mean, we're particularly proud here of our teams in Wisconsin. When we announced our vaccine requirement in late June, I would say we were around 77% of our entire Wisconsin workforce. So that includes both frontline workers and not frontline workers or not patient facing workers were vaccinated. Since that time, we've had, we believe, another at least 3 to probably closer to 5 or more percent who have provided the verification of the vaccine, which brings us closer to about 85%. And, as these days go by, we're seeing that continue to get higher and higher. And what I would also add to that if you look specifically at our patient-facing part of the workforce, those numbers are even higher. So by a large majority, our workforce has already voted with their arms.
We're talking to Dr. Matt Hanley, Interim Regional President for SSM Health Wisconsin. That organization is requiring employees to get vaccinated by September, joining many others around the country jumping in on that. You could join in with your thoughts and questions on that decision at 800-642-1234. Dr. Hanley, a hospital in Houston was one of the first to make headlines with a vaccine requirement. Some employees declined and left the organization, a small percentage ultimately. Was that a concern for you and your colleagues as you made this decision?
Well, I mean, always. I mean, I think that, none of these decisions, do we take lightly. I mean, we care for our communities, we care for our workforce, and we care for our patients. And I think ultimately we are making a decision that is in aligned with best practice evidence, evidence-based medicine, and a patient safety issue. So that's sort of the first one. And so, we're at a point where vaccination is a condition of our employment, no different than the influenza vaccine decision that was made a number of years ago. And so, similar to those vaccine requirements that we've had in place, if an employee does not ultimately meet the condition of that employment, for us, it'll be at the late September, we'll have to part ways.
And Dr. Hanley, can you talk about the practicalities here? You mentioned the deadline by late September. I know in some cases with some vaccines, people have allowed exemptions or waivers for particular reasons. Is there anything like that in your policy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're following, the guidance. I mean, I would say it's exactly the same as the influenza vaccine, and it's consistent with what the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission says, that you have to have, religious and medical exemptions. What I can tell you is that in the case of influenza, which has been in place for a number of years, that comes out to be less than 2% of our workforce who meet those requirements, and that's been a pretty consistent number over the past year. So,
turning away from hospital staff as we start to wrap up, Dr. Hanley, we are seeing places like parts of Missouri and elsewhere in the country having those crowded emergency rooms we saw during earlier peaks in the pandemic, having to shuffle people to different hospitals in some cases. Do you want to share your thoughts, your message for the public to make sure you're not seeing lots of unvaccinated people showing up with COVID in your emergency rooms?
I think that, first of all, I'm going to say right now in Wisconsin, we are in a better place than the rest of the country. However, the indicators of viral activity, specifically Delta variant in Wisconsin, is rising, and it's rising way faster than we feel comfortable. In other states within our system, what we, we're worried about with low vaccination rates is that we would see an increase in hospitalizations, and that is in effect what we are seeing. And in some of our hospitals, we're seeing hospitalization rates higher than we did over the winter. And not only that, we are seeing higher mortality rates. We're seeing a younger population of patients that are being affected. And then we're also seeing, we're also hearing from some of our colleagues and also within our system that we're also seeing more children being hospitalized than we saw in the first wave. So it's unfortunately affirming all the concerns we had a month ago when we made this decision.
Dr. Hanley, thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Dr. Matt Hanley is Interim Regional President for SSM Health Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about SSM Health's decision to require employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Coming up, we'll find out what's going on in hospitals and clinics around the country. SSM, not the only one making this decision. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think this is a good idea? Do you want to see your local hospital or clinic require vaccinations for their staff? If you work in healthcare, what are you seeing in your hospital, your clinic. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about healthcare systems requiring employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Earlier this week, nearly 60 healthcare organizations came out with a statement in support of mandating vaccination for health workers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see clinics, hospitals, healthcare chains require vaccinations for employees? Would you like to see a mandate to do that from state or federal government if you work in healthcare? What are you seeing? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dan Diamond is a national reporter for The Washington Post, where he writes about health, politics, and policy. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Well, we just heard from SSM Health, one of their doctors, about why his organization chose to mandate COVID vaccines. You've been following this kind of story around the country. How did what we heard from Dr. Manley fit into what you're seeing in other states?
I think what Dr. Hanley was saying lines up perfectly with what I'm seeing around the country. He made the point that SSM had wanted to move forward with a vaccination requirement, but had also hoped to hold off until the FDA formally approved the vaccines. They've only received emergency authorization. But there's been a wave of hospitals just in the past few days. Dana-Farber, an elite cancer center in Boston, or Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, top children's hospital in Philadelphia. They had wanted to wait also until the vaccines were fully approved, but said the Delta variant was forcing their hand, that they were now moving to put these requirements into place.
Yeah, that Delta variant, we heard from Dr. Manley. Why has that changed the equation so much for these healthcare providers making this decision this month now?
Well, some we knew, and more is coming out just in the past day about how Delta infects Americans, but it is clearly much more contagious. It moves faster between people who are unvaccinated. You can see this in the national curve of infections. I believe as of yesterday, we were over 70,000 infections per day, according to the Washington Post's rolling average. That's way up from about 12,000 infections per day at the beginning of the month. We did not see this steep a climb last year. And it comes at a time, Rob, when so many Americans are already protected. They have vaccines. So we know that this version of the virus is raging through the unvaccinated population and does appear to be posing some challenges to some vaccinated Americans, just given the sheer number of people who have gotten the vaccine. It stands to reason that there are going to be some of these breakthrough infections too.
As you report on this, you looked at this in part as a labor relations issue. I mentioned the hospital in Houston that lost some employees when they had this mandate. And you write, it sounds like, if I read you right, some healthcare providers were worried that if they impose these mandates and others didn't, well, they might just lose some workers to those other outfits.
You sound like a very close reader of the Washington Post. So for that, I'm grateful. Yes, I have followed the saga of Houston Methodist for some months. This was in their telling, and I think they're right. They were the first health system to require workers to get vaccinated. This was back at the end of March. They did get most of their workers to comply. I think about 97% plus got the shot. Another 2% got exemptions for various reasons. And then another 150 or so, so about 1% of workers, did decide they didn't want to get vaccinated. Some brought a lawsuit. Others did end up working elsewhere. And I think one reason that hospitals were worried was they didn't want to see that replicated en masse, where you would see every hospital trying to put this in and workers saying, we don't want to work in this moment of COVID pandemic anymore. Things had been awfully tight for months and months. So now that there is this greater push that we may need broader vaccination, especially given Delta, I think that has empowered a lot of the health organizations to hold hands and jump together into this moment.
How about labor organizations that represent healthcare workers? And you also looked at public employees where they're being required to get vaccines. What's been the response there?
The tipping point, I really thought, was this Monday. And you alluded to this, where the various medical groups, healthcare groups, came out with a joint statement Monday morning. The American Medical Association, the American Nurses Association, so on, the big professional groups said, we think it is finally time to require the vaccine. And very quickly, Others followed, government officials in New York City and California, the Department of Veteran Affairs. It did end up tipping maybe even faster than expected, given that the White House got involved too. But at the same time, there have been some unions, the teachers unions, the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, who have pushed back and said, we support our workers getting vaccinated. We just think it should be their choice. And it does get into these deeper labor issues of, if you're a union, this might be something you want to negotiate on rather than have it be ordered upon your membership.
We're talking to Dan Diamond, Washington Post health policy reporter, looking at health care providers, more of them now requiring vaccinations for their employees, especially as the Delta variant of the virus that causes COVID-19 picks up steam in many places around the country. You can join in with your thoughts on the issue at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think these mandates at healthcare providers are a good idea? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring on a caller. Joe is with us in Pewaukee. Joe, hi.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. What's up, Joe?
Well, unfortunately, I am against mandates, mainly because I think you can create a lot of hostility in this situation. I mean, I will not be shocked, unfortunately, if there's an Oklahoma City bombing somewhere because of this. That being said, I think one of the reasons people are scared is because of the genetically modified part of the vaccine. And I was wondering, are there like, I know Sinovac, which I thought it was a Chinese one, was based on old school 1950s, 60s technology where you just take the dead cell and inject it into you. Wouldn't something, offering something like that might ease enough people to get us past that like 70%?
Joe, thanks for the call. And to clarify, well, there's some genetic interesting stuff in the vaccines. They don't change the human genetic code. That's a popular myth going around. But a couple points there, Dan, from Joe. First of all, people are nervous in part because these are a couple of these vaccines are a new kind of vaccine in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I also thought it was disturbing to even bring up the idea of any sort of bombing,
right.
just to be clear.
That was my next question, yes. Go ahead.
There's anger and frustration, but let's keep in mind, as the doctor who preceded me pointed out, vaccination mandates in healthcare are nothing new. Mm-hmm. Vaccination mandates beyond healthcare, kids going to school to get their mum shots, those are nothing new. So it's been politicized. I think that's what's new. Flu shots have been required of many health workers for a long time, and those were not the source of controversy this way. The idea that this is going to be an area that remains controversial, I think the more that it is required, the more this moment will pass. Yes, there will be loud dissent, but the reason why there are requirements in places like a cancer center or a children's hospital is because many of their patients can't get the vaccine, or they get the vaccine and it doesn't work as well in say someone who is being treated for cancer and has a compromised immune system. So it's even more incumbent on workers to get vaccinated to protect them. And then this idea of other vaccines versus the ones that we're using in the US, there are some real questions about the efficacy of the Chinese vaccine. The mRNA vaccines of Pfizer and Moderna do appear to be the gold standard in protecting people against COVID.
And again, the concern about a terrorist attack related to this may be overstated, but the fear of political backlash, do you think that may have slowed down the decision by these healthcare providers not wanting to stir up controversy with these vaccine requirements for workers?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it slowed down the White House push, too. The White House has not wanted to be portrayed as mandating anything. Even when President Biden this week came out with his guidance for federal workers, the White House has danced around the use of the word mandate. They're calling it a directive that federal workers need to either get the shot or get regular testing or face restrictions otherwise. So it's something that does stir the passions. But I know that the idea of a mandate in healthcare for something like this, it's not so unusual. And we have seen countries overseas move forward with their own vaccination mandates. We are not an outlier in seeing it happen here.
And as I asked Dr. Manley earlier, we're seeing this point that I thought we were past, where COVID was going to overwhelm hospital emergency room capacity in some places. Reports that is happening now in parts of Missouri. Is this a worry? We're going to be back there in other hotspots around the country?
I think there is that fear. I spoke to the esteemed Mike Osterholm of University of Minnesota, not so far from you folks, mm-hmm. and he told me last week his team had run the numbers. There were about 100 million Americans who had not gotten the vaccine or had not been previously infected by COVID, so didn't have any lingering immunity. That's 100 million people that the virus could burn through, he told me. So that's not great looking forward as Delta continues to rise across the country so quickly. And these hotspots across the South and the Midwest make sense that it might emerge there first, given the relative lack of vaccination in comparison to, say, the Northeast. But it doesn't take very much for hospitals to get crunched. Hospitals do not want to have every single bed filled. That gives them very little slack in case there is an emergency. Hospitals usually want maybe 70 to 80% of their beds filled. And in Missouri, they did get up to about 100% at times. So that is the concern that might be replicated in states around the country.
Okay, that Houston Methodist Hospital, you mentioned the first domino there in healthcare providers requiring vaccines. Many more dominoes fell. Are you watching for more and more healthcare providers to jump on that bandwagon now? Sorry, I switched metaphors halfway through there, Dan. But you know where I'm going.
Yes, the dominoes hit the bandwagon, which is now rolling down the hill. So I do think that there will be more. Last week, I talked to the American Hospital Association. They estimated that of the 5,000 hospitals around the country, they knew of only about 9% that had gone ahead with the vaccination mandate. Just this week, in addition to the hospitals I've mentioned, Mayo Clinic has imposed a vaccination mandate. Other hospitals in my area have come out and said that they are looking at it or moving forward. So it does feel like an inevitability increasingly. And I would assume that if FDA formally approves the vaccines in a few months, that will be the final domino for the bandwagon that is now rolling downhill.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me back on Central Time.
That's Dan Diamond, national reporter for The Washington Post, where he writes about health, politics, and policy. He talked to us about the growing number of healthcare systems now requiring COVID vaccinations for their employees. It's Food Friday. Once upon a time, our next guest avoided recipes. She thought serious cooks didn't need recipes. Fast forward a few years, and that cook, Molly Boz, now swears by recipes and makes a living inventing, testing, and retesting recipes until they're just right. Her new book has a lot of recipes that can help us learn a lot about cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you learn how to cook? Did you rely on recipes or figure stuff out by yourself? What do you find the most useful in a recipe? How do you approach recipes? Cook along the way, read them carefully first. That's the better way to do it, it turns out. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Molly Boz is a recipe developer, author of the new book, Cook This Book, Techniques That Teach and Recipes to Repeat. You may have seen it on a New York Times bestseller list near you. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
As I mentioned, you love recipes now, but you didn't used to. What did you have against recipes back in the day?
Well, back in the day, I got my career start working in restaurants as a line cook. And so this was way before the idea of working in food media or at a food publication developing recipes was even on my radar. And at that point in my life, being a line cook was a point of pride for me, and it felt as though having to rely on a recipe was indicative of not being on top of my game and needing somebody else to lead the way for me. And so I was really resistant to recipes and was most proud of my food when I would make something just sort of like straight out of my head without referencing anything at all. And I then later took a job at Bon Appetit and started to become a recipe developer. And that's when kind of everything changed. And I realized that recipes are actually incredible because they are the culmination of many rounds of testing and so much research and thought and care. And it's not something to be ashamed of. It's something to be proud of. And so I take a lot of pride in my recipes now because I put a lot of time and care and effort into them.
in your book now, you've got these recipes, and they're not just recipes. Each of them, in a way, is a learning tool, it seems like. And you actually have footnotes in some cases saying, hey, this is why we're doing this thing. Or if it's not working out this way, here's a thing you can do to nudge it in the right direction. Can you talk about how you approached writing recipes so that the rest of us can learn from them, even when we're not using that exact recipe in the future?
Yeah. You know, as I started to write this book, I thought about, you know, what the purpose of a recipe is and where I think that recipes often fall short, and how can I turn my recipes into something that really, really service the reader. And I think what the answer to that question was, recipes don't often contain a lot of information that answers the question why. And why is a big question for home cooks. If you're not a professional cook, everything is a why. Everything's a big question mark in the kitchen. And so I wrote these recipes in such a way that sort of anticipated what I think those questions would be on the part of an amateur cook. So instead of assuming any knowledge on their part, I've laid it all out for them. So that's where the headnotes kind of come into play, or the footnotes come into play at the bottom. But then furthermore, I've added QR codes right into the book, and those are printed and accessed through the camera app on your phone and take you to videos that are tutorials that I have hosted myself of some of the harder to explain techniques in cooking. So one thing that is very apparent is that cooking is obviously a really visual thing. That's why cooking mm-hmm. videos do so well. It's a great way to learn. And so I tried to think about, how can I bring that visual medium into my cookbook and sort of amplify the learning experience for my readers?
We're talking to Molly Boz. Her new cookbook is called Cook This Book, Techniques That Teach and Recipes to Repeat. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Were there recipes, were there cookbooks even that made you a better cook? What do you look for in a recipe? What is super helpful to you? What pratfalls have you encountered in recipes past? Call 800-642-1234. Molly, before you get to the recipes, you give some general rules. And one of them is one that I mentioned earlier and that I've run afoul of before. Read the recipe first. I know one time I was making scalloped potatoes on a deadline and I didn't read the recipe first. And then midway through, I found an extra half hour of baking that I didn't know was coming. And dinner was very late that night. Talk about the importance of carefully reading the thing first.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I feel that cooking and following a recipe actually requires a lot of concentration and focus on the part of the cook. And so the best thing you can do to set yourself up for success is to sit down out of the kitchen and read all the way through the recipe to kind of get like an oversight, lay of the land sense of how this recipe is meant to go down. That way, when you're in the weeds in the kitchen, actually in the middle of cooking it, you know what to anticipate next. And it's not the first time that you're learning that you need the onions need to be chopped before they go in the pan. And so it's a matter of sort of like acclimating yourself to the recipe before you even enter the kitchen. And I think that will help eliminate a lot of the stress that novice cooks often feel.
You write that time management and order of operations are a couple of the biggest challenges for non-professional cooks. And I can relate. Like I'm pretty good at my workflow now. It took me a long time to get there. What kind of things should we be thinking about as we manage what to do when?
So one other thing that I've done with the recipes in this book is I've laid out sort of the timeline for cooks so that they don't have to think about that themselves. Oftentimes you'll find recipes where the ingredients themselves are listed at the top of the page, and then there's a comma after each ingredient, and it explains how the ingredient should be prepared. So it'll say one onion, comma, diced, three garlic cloves, comma, sliced. And that very manner of formatting a recipe assumes that the cook knows when to prep those things out. And in my recipes, I have eliminated that and put the prep into the recipes so that I will tell you throughout the recipes, now is a good time to start chopping your onions. And while they're sizzling, we can go back to the cutting board and chop your herbs. And so that's the time management kind of element of things that can really create efficiency in the kitchen.
You have a great checklist in the book. And we've all been in this position, I think. I made a thing and it's okay. You know, it's not great. It wasn't what I envisioned when I started. Can you give us a couple tips on diagnosing that food that's okay in a way that we can fix it up and perk it up a little?
Yeah. So I think the first thing, and if you've ever looked at any of my recipes or heard anything about me, you may know that I feel very strongly about the importance of salt in cooking. And I believe that salt and under seasoning is the number one culprit of kind of lackluster food that's coming out of home kitchens. So the first thing that I would say to any home cook, if they make a meal, they're about to sit down to it, and they think to themselves, this tastes kind of meh, is to check the seasoning. Take a spoonful, taste it, add a little bit of salt just to the spoonful, taste it again. And if it starts to transform and to taste really vibrant with just the addition of salt, then you know that you've under-seasoned your food. So that for me is the ultimate first step in adjusting a pretty meh meal. And then it goes down to sort of thinking through the ingredients that are in the dish that you're creating and asking yourself, is this ingredient pulling its weight in the recipe? Can I taste the garlic in this stew? If I can't, should I add some more right now? So it's kind of systematically working your way through the flavor profiles that are present in any given dish and considering whether or not they are functioning properly and holding their weight in the recipe. And then the last kind of tip that I think often gets overlooked in cooking is the importance of texture. And oftentimes, you know, it's easy to roast a pan of carrots, but that same pan of carrots can be so much more dynamic if you can add some kind of texture to it at the end. So maybe you have breadcrumbs that are toasted and already sitting in your pantry, or maybe you have some roasted nuts that you can chop up. Adding texture to food is a great way to bring it to the next level. And I think that it's something that home cooks should pay more attention to as they start to craft their own food.
It's Food Friday. Molly Boz is with us, recipe developer, author of the new book called Cook This Book, Techniques That Teach and Recipes to Repeat. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you do when a recipe isn't going as well as you thought it would? How do you fix it? Do you have a question for a professional recipe developer? What do you look for in a good recipe? What pratfalls have you encountered while cooking from recipes? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with recipe developer Molly Boz about her new book. It's called Cook This Book, Techniques That Teach and Recipes to Repeat. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you look for in a good recipe? What throws you off sometimes in recipes? What kind of questions do you encounter? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Martha on Facebook. Martha says, I've made my mother's meatloaf recipe for 30 years. Tried to change some things once and it was not as good. Always make her recipe to the letter. Molly, I was interested in asking you, actually, when can we feel free to experiment with a recipe? When should we do what Martha does and follow it to the letter?
So my kind of philosophy on this is you should always follow a recipe strictly, like word for word, the first time. If it's the first time you're encountering that food, that dish, important to trust the recipe developer and let them lead the way for your first round. Once it comes to the second and third time and you feel like you have a good handle on how to execute the recipe and what it should taste like, that's when you can start to get creative and start thinking about substitutions and swaps that you can make.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jane is with us in northern Wisconsin. Jane, hi.
Hi. I learned to love reading recipes in law school like 30 years ago.
because if I took a study break and I started to read a novel, I'd never go back. So my aunt gave me a stack of Better Homes and Gardens cookbooks, 1950s, 60s recipes, and you can sit and just read them and learn how things go together and what goes and what doesn't and what you like, and it makes you a better cook. But you're absolutely right. You got to read it before you start. Now I cheat. Recipes I know my family likes a lot, I will print out in glue inside the kitchen cupboard. If you know which cupboards, which recipes are which cupboard, it's real easy to make them because you just open the door and there it hangs.
Jade, thanks a lot for sharing that. And she mentioned, Molly, you know, learning from recipes, what goes with what? And you spent some time on that actually in the book before you even get to the recipes. How can we start to get a feel for, you know, what acids go with what meats or whatnot?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful to kind of break down the different flavor profiles that are present in any given dish and start to think about what you're eating in terms of those things. So there's sweet, there's salty, there's bitter, there's umami, there's fatty, there's spicy. So if you can kind of go into, you know, any given meal that you're eating, aware of the flavor profiles that may or may not be present in it, you can start thinking about how to combine ingredients in such a way that makes for really dynamic food. And in my book, I have a whole sort of spreadsheet that breaks down each of those flavor profiles that I mentioned, the sweet, the salty, the bitter. And underneath each of those headers or categories is a list of the most common ingredients that sort of satisfy that one category of flavor profile. So that if you're in the middle of cooking a recipe, and let's say, for example, it calls for honey, and you're like, shoot, I ran out of honey, what can I substitute? You can reference these lists, go to the sweet category in the list, and you'll see it lists granulated sugar, brown sugar, molasses, maple syrup, dried fruit, cooked onion, stone fruit, and so on and so forth. And so you can look around your kitchen and find something that might be an appropriate substitute.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to recipe developer Molly Baz on Food Friday. Her new book is called Cook This Book, Techniques That Teach and Recipes to Repeat. We heard from Eileen in Duluth, who called in to say she gets frustrated when she sees something like 3 cloves of garlic or a small onion. She says those amounts are too vague. She wants more specificity and certainty. And I've been there, Molly. Like, are my 2 small onions the same as the medium onion that the recipe wants?
Yeah, I think that's another indicator of a great recipe is one that will sort of guide you in terms of not only the visuals, but also the weight that you should be looking for, because everybody shops a little bit differently. So a lot of times you'll see a recipe that says 2 red onions, but then it'll tell you, like, once chopped, you should have about 4 cups of chopped onions. And that's a really helpful way to gauge, you know, whether you're shopping appropriately.
You've got a couple of recipes you shared with us. We've got them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. I want to check out at least one of them, and you're going to have to help me with the pronouncer. My French isn't so good. Strip steak au poivre for pepper.
Poivre.
Au poivre. Now I know. Tell us about this. I'm looking at the picture right now, and it looks fantastic.
Yeah. So this is a recipe. It's a classic French dish. It's not something that I invented myself. But it's sort of my take on it. And it is, I'm a huge black pepper fan. I think that a lot of people think that black pepper is sort of only to be deployed in tandem with salt. And, you know, 1 or 2 cranks here or there is sufficient. And that's why I love this recipe, is this is a recipe that's literally all about the black pepper. And it calls for so much black pepper that you get to actually experience what black pepper tastes like. It's not just an afterthought. It's the sort of main event of this dish. And you'll take freshly ground black peppercorns that are coarsely ground and not finely ground and bloom them in some butter, which basically means to kind of sizzle the peppercorns in butter so that their fragrance and their aroma permeates all of it. And then you'll add cream and turn it into this, like, really spicy, but also luscious, fatty cream sauce to pour over a steak.
That looks really good. Again, you can find that online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Another interesting thing about your book, I thought, Molly, was that you organize your ingredients into where I'm going to find them in my grocery store. Can you talk about why you focused on that as part of the convenience here?
Yeah, I think it kind of all goes back to this like efficiency in the kitchen conversation and really wanting to streamline things as much as possible for my reader. So if I think about the way that I navigate my kitchen or the grocery store, it's that I'm in a specific kind of department of my kitchen gathering ingredients. So if a recipe ultimately calls for garlic, basil, lemons, and zucchini, but they're not all listed together, then I'm going to spend so much time going back and forth looking for those things, you know, jumping to the pantry for my sugar, then back to the refrigerator for my zucchini, then over here for something else. And so I've tried to organize things in such a way that allows you to move really swiftly around the kitchen and only spend a dedicated amount of time in any one place. So if you're going to open the fridge, you might as well get everything that needs to be in the fridge out at the same time. And that's sort of all part of this philosophy that I learned when working in restaurants on the line, which is that if a great cook is an efficient cook. And so the goal is always to sort of minimize the extra movements and the extra time spent doing anything. And therefore, cooking will really become this kind of song and dance.
In our last minute or so, you also introduced me to a highly technical culinary concept, the word zhuzh, as in zhuzh it. What? Can you give us an example of what zhuzhing is?
Yeah. So zhuzhing is basically a practice of taking a look at what you're eating and kind of asking yourself, like, what's it missing? What does it need? What kind of like fun little condiment can I add to this to make it better? I feel like a huge part of good cooking comes down to the condiments and the sauces and the pickles and all the sort of little added ingredients that can really bring something to life. And so zhuzhing is just figuring out what those things might be and pairing them with your food. So the back of the book has a whole chapter which takes all of the dressings and sauces and condiments and croutons and sprinkly things that are within the book, within the recipes, and collates them all in one section in the back. So that if at any point you're looking to like spruce things up and you're asking yourself, what could I add here to make it better? You can hone in directly on a recipe, a sub recipe or a dressing that you think might make things better.
Molly, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Molly Boz is a recipe developer. We talked with her on this edition of Food Friday about her new book, Cook This Book, Techniques That Teach and Recipes to Repeat. You can still share your thoughts, maybe a cookbook that inspired you and changed your cooking, hopefully, for the better. Tell us about it on the Ideas Network Facebook page.